How can UX keep up with AI? We'll be exploring this question on our first Ask Us Anything episode. I'm Josh Tyson, and I'm joined by Rob Wilson, CEO and co-founder of OneReach.ai. As you'll hear, digging into this question sent Rob back to his time working in Hollywood decades ago. As part of the sound department at Warner Brothers, he contributed to films ranging from Galaxy Quest to The Thin Red Line, and learned that success boils down to storytelling. People love stories, and if you give them a compelling one, they will follow you. Rob also founded one of the world's first UX agency and shares his perspectives on the ways that experience design is being affected by conversational technologies. At its core, effective design is contingent on two things, on good taste and a good story, and today's question inspired a deeper look and how these things fit together. If you're new to the show, Rob and I are the co-authors of Age of Invisible Machines, the first best-selling book about conversational technologies and agentic AI. This podcast is where we continue the conversations we started in our book, exploring insights that we think have real meaning to the rapidly growing community of people working with this new wave of technology. Many thanks to our diverse audience base who provided scores of fascinating questions that we will continue to visit in these Ask Us Anything episodes. We heard from AI lifers, professors, enterprise product owners, those who are new to UX, and some diehard operations people wrangling AI agents. Right now, let's hear from Dr. Arena Wagner, a subscriber and UX researcher based in Denver, who works at one of the largest healthcare companies in the U.S. Please support our show by visiting our sponsors. This episode of Invisible Machines is brought to you by OneReach.ai. Building good AI is hard. OneReach.ai gives you turnkey private architecture and the tools your team needs for building AI agents that can do real work. Their powerful GSX platform lets you avoid vendor lock-in, use any LLM in the marketplace, build secure solutions with reliable guardrails, incorporate legacy software, and create production-ready automation with enterprise-grade safeguards. For anyone who is serious about automating their organization, the GSX platform from OneReach.ai has everything you need to get started. Learn more about orchestrating AI agents for your team by visiting OneReach.ai.
Hi, Rob and Josh and all of the producers of The Invisible Machines. My name is Dr. Arena Wagner, and I'm a user experience researcher based in Colorado. Currently, I'm a contractor at one of the largest medical technology corporations where I support development and implementation of a GenAI assistant for all the employees of this corporation. As I have been in the GenAI space for the last several years, I've noticed this interesting approach to product development where our traditional design thinking seems to have been inverted. Instead of starting with user problems and coming up with solutions with a product, we're seeing more and more organizations deploy a general purpose AI and then trying to find user problems that this GenAI might solve. So my question is, as UX practitioners, how might we reconcile this solutions first approach with human design principles? And in general, I'm wondering if now could be the time that we come up with a new design thinking framework that is better fit for the GenAI first world. Thank you.
So not a new problem. Design first world is a I wish world that we've all as designers been fighting for, and I would argue never accomplished. Design is we've forced a wedge, you know. Like design's a wedge we've forced in enough, but the world continues to not appreciate the value of design. And I think that has a lot to do with how hard it is to do it well, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And users tend to appreciate the value of good design, but like
users do 100%.
Business.
And that's just clear.
Yeah.
And the bottom line does, mm-hmm. That's just clear. it's the people in the middle that run companies that don't, you know, Steve Jobs was an anomaly.
Yeah, sure.
Bottom line. And you could argue wasn't even replaced by a designer. It was replaced by someone in logistics. This guy's a supply chain guy. So I think we understand that businesses value scale and not creativity.
Mm.
And I think that has to do with a designer conundrum, which is if you want to be successful and get paid well as a designer, you got to work for a big company, and big companies don't give a crap about innovation and design, just scale.
Mm-hmm.
So you can be poor and do good work, or you can have a good salary and do shit work and be unvalued and undervalued. And I think every designer I've ever worked with always fights with this, you know. And I think it's also why a lot of designers end up working at services companies, because it's as close as you get to the value. At least you're not within your organization, you're valued, even if your client's organization doesn't value what you do. And at least the clients pay accordingly because they're kind of forced to. So AI just hasn't changed that. The internet came along and people undervalued design. And we barely fought to get a seat at the table from the design side. I would argue my whole career, I've focused on technology and design. I've become, on purpose, a great technologist. Now, that sounds like tooting my own horn, but that was my objective. Whether I've achieved it or not is another story. But I've realized that if I want a seat at the table, a real seat at the table, I can't just do design. I have to treat design like knowing a second language, that you have to have something else that gets you at the table so that you can bring design. You're like the Trojan horse for design, right? And I think the design community has this problem. A lot of designers are siloed as designers. They've boxed them in. And the new world is what, you know, we've always called diviners, right? And I don't think it has to be development and design, but it has to be something else and design. Like systems thinking and design, systems design plus design. But there something else that gets you to the table, right? And then you bring design with you, and you bring that design thinking with you. So I think the biggest problem with the community is most designers just want to be designers. That's the bottom line. And with AI, it's no different. Companies bring technologists and the people who can operate this technology to the table. And then those people, if they don't bring design with them, which they often don't, they consider themselves designers. Then design's not at the table. And here it is playing out again. Because at the end of the day, they don't want you there, which is so weird, right?
Yeah. It is strange.
They don't want you there.
Maybe it has something to do with uncomfortable or expensive truths that might be revealed if someone's like looking at it with that design lens, right?
Yeah. I think creativity and productivity battle each other. You know, and if you look at these industries like the film industry that, you know, I spent quite a bit of time on technology, again, balancing the two things, technology and creativity. And you look at it in an industry that's, you could say, compared to most, has succeeded. at striking this balance. Technology is a second fiddle. It just enables the creativity.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason is because distribution doesn't even happen until the thing's done. You know, I remember like the trailer folks would like call us, you know, while I'm working on like Thin Red Line, and we're sitting on the stage with Terry Malick, and he's discussing why the bird calls in the Philippine Islands that we put in weren't native to the Philippine Islands at that time during World War II. And his Audubon Society friends are all going to like shame him if we don't get this right. And the trailer guys come in, you know, and no one has the time or wants to talk to them.
And by the trailer guys, you mean the people like making the trailer for the feature?
Yeah. Yes. Making the trailer so they can get out the ads.
Yeah.
We're not even done with the movie.
Especially with someone like Terrence Malick, that's going to be probably the absolute last thing on his mind.
Exactly. All of
the trailer for the movie. He's thinking about the birds. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He's thinking about the birds and the Audubon frames.
Uh huh.
and they're, you know, slapping in bird calls probably made by humans in an ADR stage, mm-hmm. just to get the trailer out. So this tension exists, and the question is, how does it dominate? The truth of AI is that AI within the next few years is going to diminish the importance of technology immensely.
Yeah,
and
but it won't diminish the importance of design, right?
It's going to increase and expose the importance of design. Because now technology won't bear such a strategic place at the table. Your capabilities technically are going to be taken for granted, just like it is in the film business. You can get a camera,
mm-hmm.
and you can get a good camera. You don't have an advantage because you have a special camera. You have an advantage because you have a special cinematographer.
Totally.
This is where this is. Josh, you and I went through the coding. I showed you how I'm coding every day now. Mm-hmm. Couldn't do that mm-hmm. before.
No.
And I'm designing. I'm not coding anymore. I'm designing. On the fly, fast.
That's the thing.
Just happening.
You talk about diviners and like the coding and the designer are almost like happening at the same time sometimes.
Exactly. Like,
and I think maybe that's where there's some disconnect for experienced designers is that they've been in viewing it one way for so long that they're not seeing that really like, yeah, the technology moves further the background, and that actually allows you more control over what you're designing, and maybe even puts you in position to design scalable things without kind of needing to go through the flaming hoops. Like you could deliver something that's scalable, and then all of a sudden, like, wow, you're very valuable to the people who normally don't want to hear from you.
Yeah, and if we think about what good design is, it's overly simplified. It's good taste, general knowledge about things, right? Which contributes to good taste.
Yeah. I think there's Rick Rubin adds another thing too, right? Isn't it like it's having good taste, and then it's also like believing that you have good taste, like believing in your choices because you trust that you have good taste. Like there's people that have good taste that maybe don't know they have good taste. But then there's people who know they have good taste. And they 100% believe that they have good taste. And so the choices they make creatively are just going to be the right ones.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I guess it depends. Like, you're right. So you have confidence that you have good taste matters. But I tend to focus on the things you can control.
Sure, sure.
Having confidence isn't one of those. I know a lot of folks are out there giving advice to people. I think somebody once called it like the symptoms. I call it like the simulation. They give you like, it's like an actor taking acting classes. Mm-hmm. Like, here's how you can act like a person with confidence. But that doesn't actually give you confidence.
No, maybe over time, but.
Yeah, there might be a fake it till you make it component, which I definitely could sort of see. But at the end of the day, what's going to give you the confidence that you have good taste? Well, having good taste.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the feedback loop will tell you if you have good taste, the things you choose will get complimented and that will build your confidence. How do you have good taste? I've learned this from all of the years of art at all of the levels, and that is good taste is about raising the bar. It's about knowing what's not good enough. It's a cultural thing. I know we all want to believe it's something inherent in us, but it's not.
Oh, it's more like just responding to some like a wavelength that's already kind of out there.
Yeah. Yeah. You listen, you know, and on the scoring stage, right? You listen to a soundtrack and it's not good enough till it's good enough. And if you think it's good enough before it's good enough, then you have bad taste. You know?
So there is a litmus test. Okay.
Yeah. And the people around you, you'll play off of. So they did a test with a group of individuals where on one side of the card, there's a single line. And on the other side of the card, there are three lines of different length. Everyone's in on this thing but you. You're the only one who doesn't know. Now you watch everyone go up, and on the right is line A, B, and C. And on the left, you're supposed to match the length of that line with one of the lines on the right. Now it's very obvious which one it matches. It's very obvious. But 70% of the people, just because everyone before them picks the wrong line, the shorter line that clearly doesn't match, 70% of people pick what other people choose over what they know to be the line that matches. We are so influenced, incredibly influenced by the taste of the people around us that we'll like something we don't like just because they like it. So when you move into this higher level of art, this, you know, like in the film industry, it's very clear. You're like a wedding videographer, you know, and then you move to maybe local television, you know, and then you move to television commercials, and then you move to TV, and then you move to, I mean, that's how it used to be. Now it's who the hell knows.
Yeah.
And then you're doing feature films. Well, since you have this like escalation and the budget and the time that you're given is also moving as you move up, these people at each step, you can see when they're new because their bar's low, and you can see how quickly they assimilate and their taste changes the second that they go from TV to feature films. These guys adapt because they instantly, what they thought was okay the day before is now not okay. And that has a huge amount to do with the amount of time they're given to do it and the budget they have. But more importantly, it's the people around them saying that before they would produce something and everybody, that's amazing. Now everyone's like, that sucks, go back to TV. It used to be this very clear, you know, migration from one medium up, and the taste would just align absolutely. With it.
There was like a ladder to climb, sort of. Yeah. Now it's just sort of Who knows where the edges are of that industry anymore?
And, yeah, but what we know is good is good still. It doesn't matter what the edges are. It's just harder, I think, to have good taste because it has to center within you, right? So putting that into context, you go into an organization that has bad taste and you're the only one with good taste. That's what a designer looks like today. And unless that organization's willing to defer to that designer's taste, they're going to look like they have looked. With AI, good taste and design and systems design is going to be the only differentiator. The ability to actually do it, the technical capability to do it, is going to be an assumed thing now. So the only way to differentiate will be the creative. So what I think is going to happen, and this isn't something you can force, this is something that you just have to wait for and be patient for. But what's going to happen is it's going to move to more like the other creative industries out there, where creativity and good taste is going to get elevated within the organizations on its own. And it's going to matter more because it's going to be the thing that differentiates you. So as a company, the kinds of human experiences you can provide other humans, that's going to differentiate one company from another. The kind of technology interactions you can provide is going to be table stakes. It's going to be a commodity. So people interacting with technology is going to be a given. What will end up separating us is the kinds of human to human experiences. So from a designer standpoint, what I feel like UX designers need to start thinking about is pivoting their thinking more broadly from what is the experience between a human and a machine, which is this like UX world, user experience, to a CX world, to say you got to look at the experience more broadly now and say we need to start designing human to human experiences. And what AI is going to do in all of this is be the facilitator of human to human high quality interactions, not the facilitator of, not the provider of it. It won't be the one providing the human to human experiences. It will facilitate high quality human experiences. And that's, so now we think about design. Wish I could remember his name, but a chip designer that's, you know, iconic, designed many of the chips at Intel. And it wasn't long in his career where he went from an engineer of chip design to an engineer of human design that make chips. And when he talks about Moore's Law, he talks about Moore's Law being a product of the teams and how the teams are constructed. That's what's actually kept Moore's Law a consistent and reliable formula for expecting what's going to happen. Moore predicted the trajectory of innovation, because this innovation came in all sorts of different ways. Whenever they double the speed of a chip, it's never the same way. And it's never by the same team.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you explain a prediction of that? You explain it by saying, if you structure your team in such a way that, and you give them the goal of doubling the chip speed, and you engineer the teams to be able to do it, then they hit the target. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy, in other words, that chip speeds double. And what it required was him to move away from caring about being a great engineer of chips and become a great engineer of human systems that create chips. And I think the same thing applies to designers. We need to start including the human in the loop now. And we go, like, everything's going to be the facilitation of human to human interactions versus machine to human. Designing the machine to human interaction isn't going to be a thing. that we value, it's going to be a given. So I believe that designers need to start thinking more holistically. They need to stop being in the world of the interface and contextualize the interface, because that interface is part of an overall workflow that some human has. So if I'm shipping a package, you know, FedEx, for example, shipping a package is part of a bigger workflow. And there may be a UX designer that designed the interface to ship a package, but their domain and their scope is not broader. Designers need to start caring about the broader context of when somebody ships a package, and they need to start being concerned about the hierarchy of workflow. So if you think about how decision-making gets made with humans, any task is broken into hierarchy. It's a hierarchical system. Like, I need to get from here to Denver. Okay, great. In order to do that, I'm going to need several things. One is a ride to the airport. Another is a place to park. Another is a ticket. Another is a hotel. Like, these are all subtasks. And within those subtasks, there are subtasks, right? And so you have a designer that's designing down a hierarchy, and they're designing down at the bottom without the real broader context. And it's not that they don't know it. They may be thinking about it if they're good at design, but it's out of scope. Now designers have to think at all hierarchical levels, from top all the way down. And the micro level is going to matter a lot less. There isn't going to be a huge need for designing the specific interface for shipping a package, because AI will design that on the fly. And it's going to be contextualized and customized for you and your situation so that it can expedite. So no longer do designers need to get down into what does the interface need to look like to ship a specific package. They can take that for granted. They got to move up the stack and up the hierarchy to say, okay, what's the bigger workflow? Because that is a package that's being shipped because a marketing person is going to a trade show. And that those materials need to get to that trade show at a certain time and end up at a certain place. And there's logistics to getting it picked up, getting it boxed, getting it packed, all of those things that now this will become the designer's scope of knowledge. Is it won't be an application for shipping something. It's going to be an application that helps plan a trade show, and part of that will be getting the stuff there.
That's interesting too, because design, you know, at least like 10 years ago, and it certainly remains true, but like good experience design was always sought after to be like holistic and to be carried
all
through
words, though. Yeah.
Yeah. To be carried throughout all the touch points in a company, right? Like that's what a really good experience design would be. But now you're saying too, that designers themselves need to look at their position more holistically and broaden their scope and go up the chain. And that as like in this new technology paradigm, you kind of mentioned that bad design just gets exposed very quickly. And so it doesn't seem like, you know, to Arena's question, it's not so much that there needs to be a new framework for design thinking. Like design thinking might actually become a little more top of mind, right? Like
we have to execute the framework we already have, and never get to actually execute.
Yeah. So maybe it gets closer to actually being executed upon.
Yes. It's like actually going to matter, and designers are going to become elevated in organizations, because that's what's going to matter. And the organizations that don't elevate designers will start to fail and lose their designers, because there'll be other alternatives. There'll be places for those good designers to go. So I think there's this overall concept that design is going to come to designers. Designers don't necessarily have to go to design. That being said, within the design world itself, you know, I find designers to be late adopters. and that of new technology, and that's a problem. Mm-hmm. I think that's, if you want to survive and succeed, now we're in the bubble of design, not how do designers succeed in the bubble of, you know, other roles in an organization or other roles in the world, but let's talk about in the bubble of design, how do you separate yourself from other designers? Because there's going to be a lot of new designers coming in, you know, there's going to be a lot of people looking for a new job, and design is where they're going to come because technology is not going to be an option. As this gets more competitive, the way to separate yourself is going to be to A, move up the stack and start to adopt AI aggressively instead of hesitantly. Mm-hmm. I think that's always the problem with good design, is the familiarity component. You know, people want to design stuff that's familiar, but mm-hmm. familiar is not innovative.
Yeah.
And we get stuck in a rut because people don't want, they want 10% new. They don't want 50% new. They want new ideas, but only 10% of it. And the rest they want, they don't want the cognitive load of a completely new concept in design. But where conversation design comes in is you get the best of both worlds. It is a familiar yeah. interface. Mm-hmm. So we don't have, even though it's 100% different than anything else we've ever used with machines, for the most part, it's familiar. So we get the best of both worlds. So you get to lean in. We're going to move really fast because people, it's a familiar paradigm, but behind the scenes, it's unfamiliar. So machines talking to each other in natural language, as we're starting to see happen, mm-hmm. will change the world. But adoption's going to happen quick because it's something familiar. So I think it's going to come to designers. I think designers leaning into UI. The AI UI, what does this look like? From the very beginning, it's, you're going to create a graphical UI because you have to. What's the conversational component to that? And I'm not talking about bolt-on AI. How do you add a couple features into your UX dashboard that have generative, but how do you create a completely conversational experience alongside it?
Yeah. And Arena is a researcher, a UX researcher. So especially, I guess, in terms of tech adoption and things like that, like what, if you were focused on the research side, what would you be looking to do first in terms of like catching up with technology? And then also, you know, it does seem like some research is plowing ahead using LLMs and other generative tools in ways that might not really be giving you great results in terms of what you might be looking for.
Research is interesting, and it's going to be really, it depends on who you are as a person. But for me, it becomes really, really fun. The one thing I didn't like about research is how long it takes and how laborious research is. Mm-hmm. I love research. I love discovering things, but I've always hated the laborious side of it and the time consuming side of it. But now we're going to need 100 times more research because we're going to have to move 10 times faster. And so researchers are going to be turning out research projects. Like what was a month of research will now be like a day. So every day or every 2 or 3 days, they'll be doing new research. But the demand for research will outpace even the fact that AI is going to enable them to do research at that speed. It's still, the demand's going to outpace the supply. The idea of AI doing research instead of researchers doesn't make any sense. Because that's just that's the table stakes. Whatever research an AI can do will just be
it won't be novel, right?
Well, like, yeah, we'll just be the, it will be like the, yeah, there'll be nothing novel about it. It'll be what everybody else can do. If you want to separate yourself, which we're in a competitive world, this is capitalism, mm-hmm. you're going to have to use whatever the AI can come up with as a launching point. That's your starting point for research. And you're going to have to add the secret sauce that makes you different. And novelties being key, you're going to have to surprise people. That's what we want with our experiences. We want just the right amount of surprise. So, or the right amount of error. You know?
Yeah.
We yeah. have our pattern recognition, right? Like, we've done a couple episodes on this, you know, this active inference, which is we as humans predict what's about to happen, and then we error correct if it doesn't go the way we thought. And
yeah.
And if it goes exactly as we thought, we're bored. If it goes too far off of what we thought and it's negative, we're stressed. If it goes positive, we're happy. You know?
Yeah. There's that sweet spot where our mental map of the world matches yep. the world, at least to yep. a degree enough that we're not uncomfortable with it.
Yes. And AI does a really good job of producing what we expect to see, but it's also boring. So then you have to add the 10% of novelty to make it good. And that's what designers will be. They'll be the extra 10%.
As you said, like, this technology really exists to facilitate better to human yes. interaction.
Yeah.
And so designers have an opportunity and to really focus in on that and hopefully really elevate that. Cause I think that's where this technology shines and is most impactful in positive ways is when it's
yeah.
facilitating better interactions.
If I want to go first principles on it, I would say that the most important thing that's going to emerge from all of this is stories. The stories. We're going to care about stories. So you and I have talked about this, the abstraction of intelligence. What is the term we were talking about to Tim Wood about, and he came up with a term for an object that has abstracted intelligence in a digital twin.
Oh yeah, ambient intelligence.
Yes, ambient intelligence, where the intelligence of something exists somewhere else, like in a digital twin. So designers become more storytellers, right, than designers. And storytelling becomes the new design, not colors and rounded corners, but stories. And what's going to be important is the story behind everything. You know, what will differentiate our stories. So we love stories, and that's the first principle, right? Storytelling mm-hmm. is at the core of what humans get dopamine from, right? They love stories. So telling stories become the key to design. It's storytelling. And the good news is we're not going to want to buy anything without a story. And now when I buy a chair, a wooden chair, and I put it in my house, I want to talk to that chair. And through ambient intelligence, where that chair exists in a digital twin somewhere and I can talk to it,
mm-hmm.
I can just talk to that chair, find out the story of where the wood came from, the tree, the place, possibly the person who cut it down, what they planted in its place, how the wood was milled, where it went next, who made the chair, and who designed the chair, and the story behind who designed it, and how it came to be in my house. And if that story is boring, I may not and likely won't buy the chair, because there'll be plenty of good looking chairs.
Mm-hmm, with better stories.
Yes. And those are the chairs I'm going to buy, the ones with the better story now, because nice looking chairs will be a dime a dozen. but stairs with good stories won't be, unless it's a lie, in which case it still counts because it's just fiction. But as long as it entertains me and I believe it, it's fine. So who's going to make up the lie, right? Who's going to tell the story? A storyteller. So I think what ambient intelligence tells us is that everything's going to need a story, which means the demand for storytelling goes up. As far as user research goes, you could think of research as uncovering the story. It's almost like instead of a researcher now, we're sort of looking at them as journalists looking for a story. We could say, just like in writing, it's the end of writing and the beginning of storytelling from a like value standpoint. There'll be more storytellers and fewer writers. And we only called them writers because there's a technique writing that you had to know. It's like a painter. Are they a painter or a storyteller? You know?
Yeah.
Are you a UX designer or are you a storyteller? Everyone that's good is a storyteller. Are you a director, a producer? Are you a cinematographer or a storyteller? If you're just a cinematographer, then someone else is telling the story and the success is going to depend on the story first. So now we have a world where the cinematography you can take for granted. It will be in frame. It will be lit properly. Who cares?
Yeah, if the story is bad.
Yeah.
And is it connecting with other humans? So.
Yeah. And the story between humans matter. Telling each other's story. And that's always going to be a thing. And that will continue to be a thing. And that's what UX folks should start focusing on, is what is the story that matters and how to tell a story and how to manifest a story in an experience. When I think about user experience, I don't think about the how do I get something done. I think about the how will it sound when you explain to someone else how you got it done. Will they want to do it too?
Yeah.
When you tell someone else, if you tell someone else, which by the sheer nature that you told someone else, it's become remarkable, hopefully in a positive way. Does that other person want to do it too?
All right. Well, thanks for hanging out with us again here on Invisible Machines. Don't forget to like and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Always remember that you can watch this podcast too on our Invisible Machines YouTube channel. Head over to uxmag.com. We have a podcast page there where you can explore our back catalog and you can look at episodes centered around popular topics. Many, many thanks to our incredible production team here in the US and in Ukraine. Elias Parker, Michael Litvinov, Allison Harshberger, Alla Slesarenko, Vera Pokodkov, and Darina Moskovchuk. Till next week, Owagi.